Hello, members. We're going to start the Education Finance Division today. And I believe we have House File 2207 that Chair Dabney has up. So he will be starting here momentarily. Folks will take their seats. And we now have enough quorum to do minutes if you'd like. Has anybody had a chance to look at the minutes for the meeting of March 12th? Everybody's checking it out. Representative Marquardt, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have. Madam Chair, I'll move approval of the March 12, 2019 minutes.
There's been a motion to approve the minutes for March 12, 2019. Do I have any discussion on that motion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The minutes have been moved. And next, we have House File 2207. Chair Dabney, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2207 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in a future division report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Why don't you proceed with discussion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Luckily for everyone, I'm going to do as little discussion as possible here today. House File 2207 is the governor's education budget proposal, and with me today are Caitlin Snyder and Dr. Tom Melcher, both with the Department of Education, and they will walk committee members through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like them to start now?
Please.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the School Finance Director at the Department of Education. I'll be starting with Article 1, which is the general education article. Article 1, Section 1, and actually Section 5 and 7 through 13 are all part of a recommendation to simplify the calculation of referendum and local optional revenue for school districts and to make the calculations more transparent by eliminating the annual recalculation of referendum allowances based on the amount of local optional revenue that a district is receiving for that particular year. It would move $300 per student from the referendum allowance to the local optional allowance so that all of the revenue available to local school boards by board resolution would be in local optional revenue, and all of the revenue that's based on a vote of the voters in the district would be in the referendum revenue. All school districts would receive the same amount of revenue, aid and levy, as they currently receive. There would now be a two-tiered formula for the local optional revenue, and the number of tiers in the referendum would be reduced from three tiers to two tiers. So the bottom line here is that all of the districts receive the same amount of money they do currently, but the calculations would be simpler and we would avoid some of the confusion that we have had in the past. This provision was included in the supplemental budget bill last year that was passed by both houses. So that's an overview of several of the sections, but what Section 1 does is simply the change in charter school referendum general education calculations that relate to that that overall recommendation. Article 1, Section 2 of the bill has to do with kindergarten pupil units. Currently, we have an inconsistency in the way we calculate pupil units for kindergarten students with a disability versus other kindergarten students. With this change that you have in Section 2, the calculations would be the same for kindergarten students with a disability and kindergarten students without a disability. This section also would eliminate a provision which limits the pupil unit calculations for students in the School Readiness Plus program to only 2018 and 2019. Consistent with the governor's recommendation to continue funding for the 4,000 seats for voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus that currently expire after 2019 for those to continue into the future. Section 3 of Article 1 is where the big money is. That is the change in the general education formula allowance. The governor is recommending a 3% increase in the first year of the biennium, a 2% increase in the second year, so that would put the general education formula at $6,501 for fiscal year 20, and at $6,631 for fiscal year 21 and later. Section 1, or Article 1, Section 4 is correcting a cross-reference related to the pupil unit change earlier. Sections 5, Section 5 is relating to this referendum local optional revenue change that I spoke of earlier. This is the part that is increasing the local optional revenue by $300. So what this is doing is moving the $300 of referendum revenue that is available to school boards by board action from referendum to local optional. Section 6 of the bill is the operating capital levy equalizing factors. Because the governor is recommending continuing the 4,000 seats for voluntary pre-kindergarten programs into 2020 and 21, there are some increases in school levies associated with that, particularly in the referendum and local optional levies. And what this does is increase the equalizing factors for the operating capital program to neutralize the effect of the change in those levies tied to the voluntary pre-K program. And then Section 7 is going back to these referendum local optional changes. Section 7 is making the equity revenue line up with the new proposal for referendum and local optional, so that districts continue to get the same amount of revenue there. Section 8 are the changes in the referendum allowance. This is taking $300 off of the referendum allowance to offset the $300 that's added to local optional, and it would also continue the inflation adjustment for districts that have inflationary increases on their referendum levies. Section 9 is the referendum allowance limit, and again, as part of this change in the local optional referendum provisions, it is reducing the referendum cap by $300, again, to keep districts whole with where they are currently because of the addition on the local optional of the $300. Section 10, again, continues the changes relating to local optional and referendum, as do Sections 11 and 12. Section 13 is adjusting the calculation of tax-based replacement aid for the same change in the local optional and referendum. So moving to Section 14 of the bill, this relates to the governor's recommendation that school districts be allowed to renew their expiring referendum levies by board action in order to create a higher level of accountability as school districts do this. This would be prospective, and it would only apply if the school district has, as part of a referendum ballot, included language that states that the referendum may be renewed by school board resolution subject to a reverse referendum. So in the governor's recommendation for school board renewal of referendum levies, it would only apply to new referendums that are passed after July 1 of this year, and then only if the school board has elected to put the language on the ballot that specifies that that this will be subject to board renewal. So the voters would have an opportunity to vote on that before it was renewed by board action. Section 15 is the language relating to the renewal of the expiring levies by board action. It specifies that that would only occur for referendums that have been approved after July 1st. And again, if the ballot language called for that type of renewal to occur, and it requires that the school board adopt a resolution by June 15th for that to take place. There's also a provision as part of this for a reverse referendum. That's on page 14 of the bill, section 16. Which would say that if there is a petition signed by 25% of the registered voters of the district, that there would be a vote on the renewal of the operating referendum. Madam Chair and members, that concludes Article 1. The appropriations section is Section 17. And the repealer on Section 18 is repealing the board-approved operating referendum levy that have been moved over to the local optional.
Madam Chair, Caitlin Snyder, Minnesota Department of Education. Beginning in Article 2, Section 1, this is a recommendation from the Office of the Legislative Auditor to remove some language relating to benchmarks on adaptive assessments. Section 2 is related to a proposal that would remove an outdated growth model from statute that predates our No Child Left Behind waiver. In the development of our state ESSA plan, we moved to a different growth model. So there are a number of provisions in this bill that would eliminate references to the older growth model and update statute to account for those changes. Section 3 is, again, related to eliminating that old growth model. Section 4 is language relating to the Minnesota Indian Teacher Prep Program. This would allow grantees to partner with tribal and community colleges that may be closer to the applicant's home. Section 5 eliminates a reference to a loan program under the statute that was never utilized and was inconsistent with federal guidance. Section 6, again, eliminates the loan language and has a reference to language in Section 4 of this bill. Section 7 sets priority for teacher and teacher candidates and outlines eligibility criteria. Section 8 outlines eligible programming that the teacher candidates and teachers can pursue under this program. Section 9 is a governor's recommendation to provide for mentoring grants to teachers of color and American Indian teachers. This would be an appropriation of $2 million annually, and this section outlines allowable uses for those grants. Section 10 outlines a number of changes to the full-service community schools. The governor recommends providing $2 million in grants to this program and also outlines a number of changes in the statute. So, for example, on 29.9, there is language relating to a full-service community school initiative director. The thought process is that if you have a number of community schools in your district, there should be a point person at each school site that has a community school, as well as a district-wide point person, both for the department and for community programs that might want to reach out to the school. Thank you, Tom. Language at the top of page 30 outlines implementation and continuing grants under this program. Page 31 is largely clarifying changes and outlines reference to American Indian students. Changes on page 32 outline a number of strategies that community schools may include. Changes on page 33 outline some more permissive language to allow the development of programs based on the needs assessment through the full service community schools requirement. The change on 34.25, current statute says that every 3 years a grantee has to make a report under the statute. So what this means is that in perpetuity the grantees are supposed to be reporting to MDE. You might receive a grant one time and your expectation is that you're going to be reporting for the rest of your existence. So this would change that requirement to just match up with what the grantee, the granted funds align with.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher at the Department of Education. Article 2, Section 11 would set the maximum per pupil aid for the American Indian controlled tribal contract schools to 51.17% of the formula allowance for fiscal year 2020 and later. That would index the tribal contract aid formula to the general education formula allowance so that there would be a 3% increase the first year and a 2% increase the second year over the fiscal 19 level of funding. Currently, that formula is scheduled to be reduced from $3,230 down to $1,500 for fiscal year 2020 and later. Section 12 would change the calculation of the Department of Education set aside for the Achievement and Integration Program so that the calculation would be done based on second prior year data instead of current year data, basically so the department knows the exact dollar amount of the transfer at the beginning of the year and can do the budgeting accordingly. And sections 13 through 15 of Article 2 are equalizing the achievement and integration levy. The levy is set at, the revenue is currently divided 70% state aid, 30% property tax. This would equalize the 30% property tax portion with an equalizing factor of 30% of the state average adjusted net tax capacity. It would essentially provide state aid to three districts, the Red Lake, Net Lake, and Pine Point school districts, so that they could receive the 30% match from an equalized levy rather than having to pay money from their unreserved general fund to cover their 30% match.
Madam Chair, Section 16 is again relating to eliminating the old growth model from statute. This growth model is used in the calculation of literacy incentive aid, so to maintain the current aid levels that school districts are receiving, what we would do is put this calculation into statute to maintain the aid that people are receiving through their literacy incentive aid. Section 17 and Section 18 are old, uncodified language that this bill is just repeating. If you've ever tried to find something on the website that is in session law versus statute, it can be very challenging. So this is just an attempt to make this easier for folks. Section 19, again, is old uncodified language, just updating the reference for people that might be trying to find it online. Section 20 is the appropriation language. There are a couple of items outlined on the tracking sheet for recommendations from the governor's budget recommendations, including on line 46.14, there would be an increase in the expanded concurrent enrollment grants for the introduction to teaching courses. And on line 48.31, there's a discussion of the paraprofessional pathway to teacher licensure. This language includes an update to the requirements for the Grow Your Own grants. We would remove the 30% requirement to have 30% students of color in order to apply for these programs, and instead move to a requirement that grantees must ensure a majority of the candidates are of color or American Indian to participate in the Grow Your Own program. And then Section 21 on line 53.29, that is the repealer of the old growth formula under 120B.299 and repealing language relating to the computer adaptive testing requirement. And that concludes Article 2.
Madam Chair, Tom Melcher at the Department of Education. Article 3 of the bill is the language that's necessary to implement the governor's recommendation to increase special education funding by $77 million for the biennium in order to hold the special education cross-subsidy per student at the fiscal year 2019 level going forward. Section 1 of the bill would exclude charter schools from the new cross-subsidy reduction aid, and it would provide an additional aid payment to charter schools to offset a recommendation later in the article, which is would reduce the amount of tuition that would be paid for non-resident students. So later in the article, the governor's recommending that the tuition rate for non-resident students be set at 85% of the unfunded cost in fiscal year 20 and at 80% of the unfunded cost in later years. Charter schools would receive an additional state aid payment to neutralize the effect of that on the charter school so that they would not suffer any loss of revenue as a result of the change in the tuition rates. Section 2 of the bill is defining the new initial cross-subsidy calculations. It defines the initial special education cross-subsidy essentially as the difference between the school district's special education cost and the school district's revenue that it receives from the special education formula, as well as the general education revenue attributable to special education students.
It also defines a minimum aid adjustment multiplier as 1.046 for fiscal year 2020 and specifies that that will be reduced by 0.02 each year until it reaches 1.02. So essentially the growth factor for the hold harmless would go from a 4.6% increase to a 4.4% increase to a 4.2% increase during the course of the biennium. This section also is adding cross-subsidy reduction aid to the definition of the total amount of special education aid. It would calculate the growth cap on special education aid as the greater of the current growth cap or 54.3% for fiscal 20 and 21 or 56.3% for later years of the district's non-federal special education costs. So what this is doing is saying if 2016 was a really low year for you on special education funding, and currently the growth cap is based on fiscal year 2016 carried forward, for those districts that are struggling with the growth cap because that kind of locked them into a low year, this is saying you'd be able to get the greater of the current cap or 54.3% of your cost. So it would be providing some additional special education aid to those districts that had a low year in 2016 and are currently struggling with the growth cap. There would also be a change in the minimum aid calculation formula. It would limit that to the current calculation or 80% of the district's current cost for fiscal 20, 75% for fiscal 21. And this is to adjust for some school districts that are getting what we would consider a windfall in the special education formula, because when we froze the funding based on 2016 cost, we locked in a very high year. And so now they're receiving a much higher reimbursement of special education aid than other districts. So we're trying to neutralize some of the disparities caused by the growth cap and the hold harmless by taking into account more of the current year special education cost of the school district. Section 4 of the article creates a new cross-subsidy reduction aid equal to the district's cross-subsidy multiplied by a percentage, and it would be at 2.16% of the cross-subsidy would be funded in fiscal year 2020, 5.42% would be funded in fiscal year 21, and 5.5% for later years. So what this is doing, and this is where most of the $77 million in the governor's budget is going, would be to directly reduce the cross-subsidy for school districts that have the highest cross-subsidy. But every school district in the state has a cross-subsidy. They would receive funding for a percentage of that cross-subsidy. And then Section 5 of the article is changing the tuition billing rate from the current 90% to 85% for fiscal year 2020 and to 80% for later years. This would help school districts that are struggling with very high tuition payments from other school districts or from charter schools for special education students that are served by another school district. And as I said earlier, the charter schools have the biggest impact from this, and they would be held harmless. The state would be picking up the difference there in terms of keeping them at, they would still get 90% of their unfunded costs covered, but the resident district would only be paying the 85 or the 80%. Should I go into Article 4? Madam Chair, if I could go to Article 4 then. That's the facilities and technology article. Section 1 is clarifying that the allowable uses of the current equipment bonding authority includes the issuance of bonds for public announcement systems, emergency communication systems, and other equipment needed to reduce, provide, improve facility security and to help with violence prevention. It would also increase the limit on debt service levies from the current equipment and facilities bonding authorities by adding the amount of safe schools levy. This would not be a net increase in levies because there is an offsetting reduction in the general fund levy for the facilities and equipment levies. Then Section 2 of the bill is the safe schools recommendation. This is the governor's recommendation to provide a significant increase in the level of safe schools revenue for school districts, charter schools, and cooperatives. So for fiscal year 2020, The bill would increase Safe Schools revenue for school districts by $9 per pupil from $36 to $45, and it would establish a minimum funding of $18,750 per school district for the smaller districts. It would also increase the cooperative Safe Schools revenue for school districts that are members of an intermediate by $3.75 from $15 to $18.75. Other cooperatives that are not part of an intermediate would get the same $3.75 increase. And charter schools would also receive the same increase as school districts. They would receive the same $9 per pupil in fiscal year 2020. But then in later years, fiscal 21, the increase would go up to $18 per pupil. So that's a 50% increase over the current level of funding, going from $36 to $54 per student. The minimum revenue for the smaller districts would be $22,500. The co-op revenue would be an increase of $750 for the intermediates, going from $15 to $22.50, and then the other co-ops would just receive the same increase as intermediates of $7.50. The Safe Schools levy under this proposal would be equalized. Currently, the Safe Schools levy is all property tax. Under this proposal, the Safe Schools levy would be equalized in the same manner as the long-term facility maintenance levy, which is based on 123% of the state average ag modified adjusted net tax capacity per student. So that particular measure of adjusted net tax capacity uses 50% of the agricultural value in calculating the state and local share of the local long-term facility maintenance revenue. We would have the same aid and levy mix for the Safe Schools revenue as we currently have for the long-term facility maintenance revenue.
Madam Chair, the changes in Article 5 are just updating appropriations based on the most recent forecast. Article 6, Section 1, this expands eligible expenditures under Regional Libraries Telecommunications Aid. So currently there are two allowable expenditures. There's Category 1, which provides funding to support bringing the internet to a library, and there's Category 2, which supports providing internet within the library. This would expand eligible uses of the funds to also include other items such as perhaps purchasing computers or tablets within the library. So similar goal, similar intent. And part of the conversation about this proposal is that there's a federal match for these funds, 60 to 40 for state funding. So we want to make sure that we're meeting that match. And there's also a maintenance of effort requirement. So making sure that we're using these state resources in a way that's meeting their goal and meeting their intent and providing full access to libraries across the state. Section 2 is related to this change. And then Section 3 is just the appropriations language for this article. Article 7, Section 1. The first section would allow, it relates to the braiding of funds that can happen under School Readiness Plus. So if you're a mixed delivery program and you're braiding funds, one of the ways that you might be braiding funds is charging fees to students that are not funded through state funds. So this says that if you're in a mixed delivery program, if you're not being funded through the state program, it is an allowable use to be charged a sliding fee within that mixed delivery program. Section 2 strikes obsolete language. It separates the four current pots of funding for voluntary pre-K and School Readiness Plus. So those four pots are the Metro pot for Minneapolis-St. Paul, the rural pot, pot for charter schools, and pot for suburban schools. So this would separate the Minneapolis and St. Paul pot into two separate divisions, creating five funding streams. And then the language in Section 3 would maintain the 4,000 slots that are set to expire under current law. Section 4 establishes a special revenue fund for early learning scholarships. Members of the committee are probably aware that any general fund appropriation cancels within 24 months. With our early learning scholarship funds, the administrators have 12 months to provide a scholarship to a family. The family has 12 months to find a program that best fits the needs of their students, and then we allow 90 days to be invoiced for that expense. So that results in 27 months under the best of circumstance, under the best of forecasting for need, and that doesn't align with the general fund requirements. So this would establish a special revenue fund and to make sure that the funds that are dedicated for early learning scholarships are going out to the families that most need them. We anticipate that this might result in an additional 1,000 scholarships being awarded to students. Section 5, this is a provision to align with federal requirements. This would allow certain Head Starts to get background studies through the Department of Human Services to meet a federal requirement. This has been delayed a year from the federal government, but it is going to be taking effect in the fall, and so we need to make sure that our tribal Head Starts and our non-CCAP receiving Head Starts are able to access the background studies through DHS that meet the federal requirements. Section 6 is also related to this change. Section 7 is the appropriation language. Article 8, Section 1, this again is just updates to the appropriations to align with the forecast. Article 9, Section 1, beginning at 78.24. This is a modification in the growth factor for adult basic education. So adult basic education aid has a small growth factor in statute. They can have up to a 3% growth based on the growth in contact hours, so the number of students receiving services, the number of hours they've received over the past decade. So in a situation like right now where there's a fairly strong economy, there's fewer contact hours, which has led to a negative growth over the past 10 years. Based on the negative growth in contact hours, the department worked with the Attorney General to get an opinion about whether or not this aid is intended to go down under certain circumstances. The Attorney General agreed with MDE's interpretation that that was not the legislative intent, but just to clarify the intent, we would like to add language at 79.4, which says that the growth factor is either the greater of 1 or the lesser of 1.03. Article 10, State Agencies. Section 1 would establish a grant administration account at the department. This would allow the department to retain up to 5% of grants that are funded through the department if there isn't an amount specified for administration. So every grant that's funded through the department has a program staff assigned and an agency finance staff assigned. So the agency finance staff is responsible for the contract monitoring, for some of the fiduciary responsibilities, and the program staff is working to make sure that you're hitting the intent of the grant language. So let's say it's a grant focused on literacy, you would have a literacy specialist assigned. The agency finance staff, since their job is to work directly with grantees, they might be working on 20 different grants in a day, and all of that time has to be tracked on their time entry. So having just one billable account to track their time would be administrative savings to the department. Section 2 relates to the grant administration account. Section 3 is a fee increase for BOSA. Section 4, the governor recommends moving BOSA and PELSB to be general fund funded versus special revenue fund. Essentially, there's a timing issue where everyone is getting their license renewed at the same time, so it doesn't help support activities throughout the year. Section 5 is related to the general fund move, as well as Section 6. It looks like we're missing Section 7. Section 8 is also related to the special revenue fund versus general fund. Sorry, we do have a Section 7, it's just out of order. So Section 7, this would be the appropriation. So the first change is on line 83.8. where we would cancel $2 million that was appropriated to the department for legal fees and costs associated with litigation. The department has a number of ongoing lawsuits, and one of the most substantial lawsuits is entering the discovery period, which is the major time for billable hours as we work to gather evidence and work through the discovery process. So this would reduce $2 million that was appropriated to the department in order to fund an appropriation request later in the bill. Ms. Adrians pointed out to me that this $2 million should also have been canceled on line 82.22. So that was a good catch by House Research. Section 8 has the operating increase for the department and a number of the increases for the department that were outlined in the fiscal tracking sheet. 84.10 is the line where we would have a request for $4.7 million for legal fees and costs associated with litigation. These costs are difficult to anticipate, but this is the estimate that we've received from the Attorney General. 84.11, this would be funding for mainframe ongoing security licensing. This is the mainframe that handles all of the school aid payments, and so making sure that this is a secure system that can't be susceptible to hackers is very important to the department. 84.13 is the funding for the Second Chance Agency Director that would work with the Department of Corrections and the Office of Higher Education. 84.15 is an appropriation for maltreatment investigations at the department. This would fund two FTEs in training for schools to get them updated on new requirements. Switching documents for just a second, the members should have the A190189 amendment. This is largely technical corrections. However, at 1.9, there's language that would allow the department to investigate allegations that involve students from ages 18 to 21. Currently, we can investigate allegations that involve vulnerable adults, but not students that don't fall within that category in the 18 to 21 sphere. So the request to increase funding for the maltreatment investigations is half driven by this language that would allow us to investigate those circumstances and half driven just by the increase in allegations that are coming to the department without any statutory changes. 84.17 would be the request to fund an IT program and data integration, which would allow us to align programs like MARS and the Minnesota Common Course Catalog. 84.18 would be the request to fund the Turnaround Arts Program and support the school, the six school districts, and potentially add more school districts. 84.19 is an increase for our data analytics staff. That would be an increase of 1.4 FTEs based on the increased requests that are coming into that department. And then 84.21 would be the request to fund a staff person focused on the National Board of Certified Teachers in Minnesota. Section 9 is related to the move to general fund for Pelsey. Section 10 is the operating request for the Minnesota State Academies. Section 11 is the operating request for Purpage. And that concludes Article 10.
Thank you both so much for your work on this. Members, before we take questions, you have two fiscal worksheets, and I think Ms. Adrians is going to walk us through those, which might help us put some things in context.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'll try not to go too long into too much detail, but I do want to orient members to the tracking and this one page, just so you kind of have a sense of how to read it and look at the numbers. The one page sheet that has at the top, it says the governor's recommendations. This is just the change items only, and so this will show all of the governor's initiatives that cost, that have some sort of fiscal impact. And it, and I also have 2019 on here because that was the reduction of the litigation fees that the department just referenced. But otherwise, all the changes are for 2021, 22, and 23, and then with the total change items at the very bottom. And one other thing I want to point out on this, under Pelsby and the Department of Education, there are two items that aren't actually new spending, but it's moving money from the special revenue fund back to the general fund. Just a little note I wanted to make. So you'll see at the bottom for the first biennium, the total of all the change items is about $733 million. And then for the tails for 2022 and 2023, the total is just over $970 million. And then if you will go to the big tracking sheet, the legal sized, this has all of the items that are under the purview of the committee in it. But the way that you can find the governor's change items, as easily as possible when you're looking at these spreadsheets. So the columns that are kind of the darker gray shading, so under, I have letters at the top, so under I, M, and R, this is where if there is a difference between the governor's numbers and the November forecast, if there is a number in there, that indicates that it's a change item of some sort. And one other thing I want to point out is that for initiatives like when there's a formula change or a change in voluntary pre-K, it gets scattered among multiple programs. So for voluntary pre-K, for example, if you look at line 22, this is the biggest part of the change. So this is just under $570 million in the first biennium. And this is the money that flows through the formula to the districts. But you'll also notice on like on line 42, on line 46, on line 54, it'll say VPK maintain existing slots. So this is where if there's a little bit of money that that changes because of the voluntary pre-K change, then you'll see a little bit of an amount in each of those pieces. And then the same when there's a formula change. So the big formula allowance increase of 3% and 2%, that's on line 21. So that's where the bulk of the spending is there as well. But there are also some interactions between things like non-public pupil education aid on line 32, non-public pupil transportation on line 33. So the last thing I'll mention is that if a program is italicized on the left, that means that there is a change. So that's one other way to try to navigate the spreadsheet. I hope that's useful. Please tell me if you have any other questions.
Thank you, Ms. Adrians. Member questions. Representative Bennett, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm just wondering if the department knows, this is concerning Article 7, how many districts currently using VPK are using those funds to supplant other funds, in other words, keeping the number of children served the same, rather than using that VPK to expand access. You know, school readiness prohibits supplanting funds, whereas VPK doesn't. So do we have a handle on that, which districts are supplanting versus which districts are expanding?
Mr. Melcher, Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair and Representative Bennett, there was a similar request in the Early Childhood Subcommittee yesterday. We can provide information about how VPK and School Readiness Plus funds are being used, and to the very strong, the greatest extent that the funding is being used in the classroom for instructional purposes. What we don't have is information on how they were using funding prior to being awarded the voluntary pre-K or School Readiness Plus funds.
Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you. So, and thank you for that info. Is there a possibility of getting that information, or is that kind of just lost in the numbers shuffle?
Ms. Snyder?
Madam Chair and Representative Bennett, it's possible that our early learning staff has done surveys on this information, and I can see if we have further information on that question and circle back with you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Snyder, there's some policy in this bill that we had in the policy bill last year. Is there a reason it was put into the finance bill rather than in Representative Joachim's policy bill that she carried for the governor?
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, the relationship among the agencies is that MMB is the final arbiter of what belongs in a budget bill versus a policy bill, so as to make sure that we're not trying to sneak budget items through a non-budget process. And so anything that has a particular fiscal constraint on the department or an effect is considered a budget item for agency purposes. So this includes items like off-grade testing questions, because it might affect our contract with the testing vendor, even though it wouldn't result in a reduction of funding anywhere. So for agency purposes, anything that has a budgetary effect is sort of rounded up to being a budget item versus a policy item.
Follow up?
So, Madam Chair, thank you. So does that include the elimination of the growth references as well? Because
correct.
Those definitely should have been in policy as they were last year.
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, for our purposes, it's considered a budget item because of its interaction with the literacy incentive aid.
Follow up?
No, I just find that confusing because last year it was in the policy bill. One other question of Mr. Melcher. Under the maximum effort loan aid on 67.10, how many districts who receive maximum effort loan are receiving that aid?
Mr.
Page 67.
Madam Chair, I don't have those numbers with me. That went to the school districts that paid off their
yes.
loans. It seems to me we were, you know, in the neighborhood of 10 or so, but Mr. Strom maybe can quick look that up for you and get back. I don't want to presume that, but
Mr. Strom. Maybe.
Madam Chair, let me just look for a minute and see if we can find a quick answer.
Sorry.
Well, Mr. Strom, I think it was about 10 that we included. So it would be the same 10, is that correct?
Yes.
How about the additional amendment that Representative Davids had, where we were adding a payment to some of those who were in that iffy area, like my Ogilvie School District?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe that second number, if you turn the page back to page 66, there's the early repayment aid incentive. And I believe those were the amounts that were originally in Representative David's bill. But I'll double-check the order of those two. So there's both the early repayment aid incentive and then in Subdivision 7, the maximum effort loan aid amount. And I'll double-check my notes here real quick to see which one was which. I've got them confused now. But and to give you a list of the participants.
You can tell me offline.
Okay,
that's fine.
Perfect.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Belcher.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. You went through this quickly, so I may have missed it, but Representative Hewitt has a bill, I believe I just looked it up, House Bill 1363, a grant program for Support Our Students. Is that in here?
Ms. Schneider?
Madam Chair and Representative Juergens, no, it is not.
Okay. I would just urge the governor to consider that so that the staffing needs for our students could be accounted for there. And then one other question.
Representative Juergens.
Thank you. Commissioner Ricker was in and testified that the governor's budget doesn't fully fund schools, but she mentioned a task force that the governor would be calling together, and I didn't see that in here. Is that in this plan?
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Representative Juergens, the governor has proposed a set of budget recommendations to bring schools closer to fully funding, but he is committed to having a school finance task force as well to address ongoing finance and budget concerns from school districts. The governor has the ability to call a task force without enabling language, so that recommendation is not in either the budget or policy bill.
Follow up.
But he's still planning that task force?
Correct.
Ms. Schneider, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Schneider, I think I'm referring to a section, or rather, Article 2, Section 2, on page 40, line 46.7, referring to concurrent enrollment programs. The appropriation there is $4 million in 20 and 21, which is about where it is now. And the next line, however, is kind of, it at least confuses me. It says, if the appropriation is insufficient, the commissioner must proportionately reduce the aid payments to districts. If it's insufficient, well, could you explain that to me, please?
Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair and Representative Sandell, so concurrent enrollment is a capped program. So the funding that's available is $4 million each fiscal year. So the statute in 124D.091 outlines that the funding could be up to $150 per student per credit earned, but the funding has been insufficient to meet that level. So what's been earned by school districts is more along the lines of $53 per student per credit earned. Mm-hmm. So because there is more demand than there is aid available, all of the districts that provide concurrent enrollment are prorated to meet the cap on the funding.
Follow-up?
No, I think I understand that. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Snyder. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am just wondering if we can go back to the special aid, special education aid on page 56 and just walk through that again, because I think that's really important to all of our districts. I just want to fully understand what that looks like. So I know that you expanded the growth cap. So if you could just walk through it again, we went through this so fast, and this is really important to all of our districts. And so if you could just go over that section one more time for me, that would be very helpful.
Mr. Melcher?
Madam Chair and Representative Adelson, the governor's recommendation is to make some modifications to the special education aid formula to increase funding in an amount sufficient to hold the cross-subsidy per student on state average at the fiscal year 2019 level. So currently, we have a cross-subsidy of $830 per student on the average. Under current law, it would grow, I believe, to $897 per student by 2021. And so the governor's budget recommendations would make changes to the special education formula, increasing the aid to try to hold that cross-subsidy constant. The primary vehicle that the governor uses to hold the cross-subsidy constant would be to create a new component of special education aid called cross-subsidy reduction aid that would directly pay for a percentage of the special education cross subsidy for each school district based on the prior year's calculation. So you'd know right away early in the year what your aid would be rather than waiting until after the year was over and you then calculate the cross subsidy aid. So the cross subsidy reduction aid would be 2.16% of the prior year's cross subsidy for the first year of the biennium, and then it would grow to 5.42% for the second year. So for each school district, we'd look at what their cross subsidy was per pupil, in other words, what the unfunded cost is per pupil, and we would pay a percentage of that. So the higher the cross subsidy per pupil, the more state aid we would be providing to that school district to hold down the size of the cross subsidy. So that's the primary recommendation and the one where most of the dollars are. But there are also a couple of other recommendations. One of the recommendations is to reduce the tuition rate that is paid by the resident school district for students who are served by another school district based on a students that open enroll. Currently, the process is that school districts, the resident district pays 90% of the cost that's not funded by the serving school district or charter school. The governor's recommendation is to reduce that to 85% for fiscal year 2020 and to 80% for fiscal year 2021. So that would provide some relief to the resident school district where the student has open enrolled to another school district or a charter school. In that situation, the resident school district doesn't really have a say in the size of the program. Quite often that ends up being a more expensive program the student's parents pick because they think that's a really good program, we want to go there. It sometimes costs the residents district a lot more to pay that tuition bill than it would to provide the service in the home district. So the governor is recommending that the tuition rate be reduced from 90% to 85% and then to 80%. We know that that would be a big financial hit on charter schools if we just simply said, sorry, you're not getting part of that money. And so there is a piece of the $77 million in the governor's recommendation is to hold the charter schools harmless. So they would still be getting their 90%. The state would be paying the difference between the 90% and the 85% or the 80% for the to buy down that cost to the resident district. And then the third piece of the recommendation is to try to do some work with the cap and the hold harmless. In looking at the special education formula, many of you may have heard from your districts about the impact of the cap. We're finding that there are some serious inequities being created in the special education formula because of the cap and the hold harmless. Those were put on in 2016 when we changed from previous funding formula to the current funding formula. The calculations are frozen based on 2016 data. So the cap and the hold harmless, quite frankly, worked pretty well in 2016. They guaranteed that nobody would get less money in 2016 under the new formula than they were getting under the old formula. But what happens as we go forward, we're kind of locked into the 2016 special education aid. We have it on an automatic inflator, so we're automatically increasing the capped amount by 4.6% a year, which is kind of the average rate of inflation for special ed. But what the formula is not recognizing is that special ed programs change in school districts from year to year, and in particular, they change in smaller school districts. So we've got two kinds of inequities going here. If you are a district that had kind of an unusually high cost in 2016, that got locked in, and now we're giving you a 4.6% increase every year, even though your cost might have gone down. Maybe you had some really expensive kids in your district in 2016. They left. They're no longer there, but we're still giving you a 4.6% increase. So what the formula does is that we're adding another provision into the hold harmless that says, we're still going to give you the hold harmless based on 2016 data, but if you end up getting more than 80% of your cost covered, that's too much. We're going to cap it at 80%. So there are a handful of districts, I believe it's 12 districts across the state, they're getting more than 80% of their cost covered. Well, the average is 61%. So they're getting a pretty good deal right now. This would say, if you're over 80%, you're going to be held at 80%. Can't get more than that on the hold harmless. And then on the other end of the formula, we have some districts where 2016 was a relatively low year. So we capped them at 2016. We're giving them 4.6%. But maybe they're the district where those students moved. You know, they moved out of one district, they went to another district. So some districts have had a really big increase in their special education costs since 2016. And so for some districts, when we freeze you based on your 2016 number, we give you 4% a year for inflation, but then you just have, especially in a small district, a significant increase in your special education cost, then you have a real problem because you're getting a very low percentage of your cost funded for special education. So what the modification is to do, you know, it'd be nice to get rid of the cap entirely, but we didn't have enough money to do that. What we said was we will give you the greater of your current amount or 54.3% of your cost. So currently, if your cost has grown so much since 2016 that you're getting less than 54% of your cost funded because of cap, We're gonna raise that cap up to the 54% of your current cost. So it's trying to minimize the inequities both on the high end and the low end, so that we're funding closer to the same percentage of the special ed cost for school districts across the state.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that, elaborating on that area. The only other thing, and this might be a little policy too, but I know that there was a school district for charter schools that had were not very fiscally responsible in how they were managing special education, and the taxpayers are paying for that, and the school district had to pay for that, and so they came here to the legislature. I'm wondering if the governor, or if in this body, I don't know if that would be through your committee, Chair Joachim, but if we're putting parameters in making sure that that doesn't continue to happen in the state.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not familiar with the specifics. We do have a situation where charter schools that have more than 70% of their students in special education are funded at 100% of their cost, and the school district pays the bill. So we have kind of a two-tiered system where if you're under 70% special education students, we have this 90-10. If you're over 70%, then it's 100% funded. So we kind of inevitably have a difficult situation where the school district is almost entire, or the charter school is almost entirely special education students, and the costs are really high. The school district is going to end up paying the bill, But if we pay less than 100% of the cost, then the charter school goes out of business. So it's a situation that kind of begs for some additional creative work. At this point, the governor's recommendation has not addressed that issue. We know that it's out there.
Follow-up? Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifiers, I'm not sure who answers this correct or who will answer this best. On page 7, as we look at the referendum allowance changes, a couple of questions. I really am just trying to understand how this changes from the current law. So under the start with the current law.
Okay, Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, under current law, we have the operating referendum, mm-hmm. and we have the local optional revenue. So local optional revenue was added beginning in fiscal year 2015. It's up to $424 per student. So if a school district has a referendum that was passed before the end of 2014, then we take the $424 of local optional off of the referendum. So let's say you had $1,000 per pupil referendum, local optional came along, we take that $424 off, so you didn't get an increase. But what the current law does is it has us recalculate that every year. So every year we have to wait for information from the school district. They say, well, this year I want $424, this year I want something less. So every year we're saying, well, your gross referendum is this one amount, and then we're going to take off whatever you ask for. But the thing is, just about every district every year asks for the 424. Nobody says, well, I want less than 424. So we end up going through a series of calculations that at the end of the day, they're not really doing anything other than to confuse people. We had a situation, I believe it was the Owatonna School District a few years ago, that went to the voters for a referendum, and they got confused between the gross referendum and the net referendum, and they ended up asking the voters for too little money, and there was a special legislation passed a couple of years later that said, well, it was pretty clear what they meant, and the voters understood it, but the ballot language wasn't right because they were confused by this change. So what we're trying to do is to keep this the same in terms of the impact on the school districts. But we want to simplify the calculations. So what we basically want to do is, rather than asking the districts every year, do you want your 424? And if they say yes, we take it off of the referendum. We just want to say, local optional's over here, referendum's over here. We're going to take the 424 off one time. If you don't want the whole 424, then just levy less on the local optional. Don't take it off of the referendum. Don't add it back on. Right now, we got it going like this. You change one thing, it goes up on the other place. So it's just trying to accomplish the same end result, but with fewer calculations and less confusion. So what we're doing is we're just separating the two instead of having this interaction. And then the other piece of this is that we currently have, as part of that same legislation that was enacted in 2013 and 2014, school districts have up to $300 per pupil of referendum that they can get by board action. And some districts have a $300 board-approved referendum and a $424 board-approved local optional. It's kind of a contradiction in terms to say it's a board-approved referendum. So what the recommendation was last year and what the recommendation is again this year is to say if it's board-approved, it's really local optional. Let's just call it local optional, right? So what we're saying is we're going to take the first $300 per pupil of the referendum. It's really available to the board it's really local optional because the board can pass it on their own. We're going to say, rather than saying you got 300 of board approved referendum and then you've got 424 of local optional, let's just say you got 724 of local optional. It's the same $724, but then we're in a situation where if it's a referendum, it's always voter approved, you know, as it should be. The term referendum means voter approved, right? If it's voted on by the school board, then it's local optional. So all we're doing is we're taking $300 per pupil out of referendum, we're adding it on to local optional, we're changing the equalization. So right now we equalize the first 300 of referendum at a higher level than the rest. So we're taking that tier one of the referendum, we're moving it to local optional along with the higher equalization. So the bottom line is when you see your levy sheets, you're going to see $300 more on local optional, $300 less on referendum. The board approved and the voter approved are going to be more clearly separated, so it's clear to the taxpayers, you know, what's approved by the board and what's not. We lower the cap on the referendum by 300, so everybody is kind of in the same position because we took 300 out of the referendum, so we're not creating a kind of a windfall for districts that want to pass a new referendum. At the end of the day, everything is the same except that the calculations are simpler and more transparent.
Representative Kreisha.
Wow. Okay. Thank you, by the way. It was, and so let me just ask these two clarifying questions to make sure I have it correct. And I'll ask two of them in a row, and then so will the 724 in local option revenue still be included in the total amount request, or is that now completely separate? And I think you got an answer in there, but just to make sure. And then the second one, does converting the $300 per pupil allowance still require a vote by the school board and authorize up to 5 years?
Mr. Melcher.
And I can ask him again, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, I might, with the two, I'm getting a little confused. So the, I'm sorry, could you repeat?
Sure can.
Representative Kreisha.
Okay, so let me, and I've got it written down, so I'll just read it so I make sure I get this correct. So will the 724 and the local option revenue still be included in the total amount requested, or is that completely separate and off the ballot?
Okay, so.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha. That's totally separate and off the ballot. So the school district will receive a levy limitation report from the department that says you have 724 available. The school board still has to vote on it when they approve their local referendum. When they go out for a referendum renewal, that will not be on the ballot. It's totally out of the referendum now.
Okay.
And actually, we made that change starting in 2014.
Okay.
So we have the situation now where if your referendum was approved before 2014, it gets subtracted off. If it was approved after 2014, it doesn't get subtracted off. So that it's creating more confusion because some of the referendums have a subtraction and some don't. This would say for all the referendums, there's no longer a subtraction. It's just taken out. It's on local optional. The allowance you have for your referendum is the net amount after the 424 comes off.
Representative Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. And then just the other one is, so does converting the $300 per pupil still require a vote by the school board, and is it authorized up to 5 years? Because I think that's what's currently in law.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, when you move the $300 from board-approved referendum to local optional, that the school board would need to approve the levy each year, but there would not be a separate resolution to approve the $300. So currently what happens is school district has a $300 board approved referendum every 5 years that they have to have a board resolution to continue it. That board resolution would no longer be in place. The continuation would depend on the annual vote by the school board on their total levy limitation.
And last one.
Follow up.
Thank you. And okay, thank you. So now let me ask the hypothetical, and this you can help me with, because after this goes through, my school business officer is going to call me and other ones. What is there any hesitation? Will there be a sticking point where they'll call and say, this isn't a good idea? And just so I can help them through something they may not understand, is there, or is this clearing up things that they've asked for?
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Kreisha, I think this is clearing up things that they've asked for.
Okay.
This is identical language to what was in the supplemental budget bill last year.
Okay.
So we had a pretty thorough airing of that last year. We have had some concerns raised by districts about some of the confusion that's caused by having some referendums with a subtraction, some without a subtraction. I think this will just be clear for everybody.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Melcher. If we can go back to the special education cross-subsidy, and I appreciate that. And I think this is the area where we talk about whether or not our schools are getting funded. It's because of that, you know, as we heard in your presentation before, it's because the federal government is not funding their share of special education, and we are trying to make up that difference where the federal government is, you know, leaving schools across the country behind. And then now back to how we're doing that. I want to focus in on the part about the cap. Yeah. And in, you know, in trying to make whole those districts or help those districts that right now are being punished by the cap that was put in place in past legislation. So I want to go to the 54%, Madam Chair?
Mr. Melcher.
And Representative Pryor, 54.3% for the current biennium and then 56%. We're trying to gradually phase out that reliance on the 2016 data.
Got it. So we're moving it up So it was interesting numbers, 54.3 and then 50.6, and I understand that there must have been hard data that made this seem to be feasible and how all these numbers work. And I said that we're working towards that even now, the 61% that were the average cross-subsidy across school districts.
Madam Chair,
Representative Pryor, yes. So we started out as we were working on the governor's budget recommendations. I think that the first big decision was the cross-subsidy is at $830 per pupil on the average. We know it's growing. So we started out with a dollar target. You know, mm-hmm. $77 million is what it takes to hold that cross-subsidy harmless. And then we kind of backed in. That's why we have the odd decimal places is. What's the dollar? What are the formulas we need in order to make sure that cross subsidy doesn't grow, and then trying to address the cross subsidy for every district by the mm-hmm. cross subsidy reduction aid, and then trying to help the districts that are being hurt by the cap by gradually phasing that out. So we're trying to use a combination of the two to gradually do a better job of funding special education, and certainly one could say, well, maybe we should have done more on the cap and less on the cross subsidy. It becomes a question of distribution. You know, when you mm-hmm. put money on the cross subsidy aid, then every district gets a portion of their cross subsidy coverage. Yep. It's kind of an adequacy issue.
Right.
The cap is more of an equity issue. So how much do you want to put into adequacy versus equity? And it was a judgment call on the department's part in terms of how much we put into those two buckets. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to do both.
Follow-up?
Madam Chair, thank you. And just my last follow-up to understand then, at some point we need to get away from that 2016 as the benchmark and eventually move to a place where all schools actually get adequate and we don't have to make up for the equity. But we don't quite get it in this, and we're not able to achieve it in this budget year.
Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Pryor, yes, we're working with that as a goal, and we just couldn't quite get there, but we're moving in that direction.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Melcher, for Dr. Melcher, I was inspired, like I was in my math classes in junior high, when you were going through the explanation on special ed, and I was following along, and I felt so good because I was getting it. But then I looked at Mars and I said, I still don't know how it affects Duluth and 709. Can you tell me a specific? Does it make it better?
Mr. Melcher.
Please.
Madam
please.
Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, it helps Duluth. We have been working on runs. We're kind of waiting for the governor's office to let us release those. But we have done runs by district. We know exactly how it affects every district. Okay.
Well, let me tell you that there's a job out there for you as an explanation person on math in math classes. And if you do an adult ed, I'll come.
The governor does not recommend that.
Thank you.
Representative Jergens.
Alrighty, thank you. I'm on the board of directors for a charitable organization. We had a meeting last night, and one of the things we were considering is funding full-service community schools. So it ties in really well with what we're talking about here today. So I was looking through I'm on page 28, 29, and I'm curious on 29.6, talking about community-wide full-service community schools, and it includes partners that include representatives from government agencies, relevant unions, and nonprofit and other community-based programs. What is a relevant union?
Ms. Schneider, Mr. Melcher.
Madam Chair and Representative Jergens, I'm just trying to make sure I'm following this.
29.6.
Madam Chair and Representative Jergens, I believe that would be a reference to the bargaining units that are working in the school. So it might be the teachers union, it might be the paraprofessionals. The community school model works best when there's buy-in from everyone in the school district, from the administrators to the folks in the classroom. So I believe that's what's intended by that phrase.
Follow-up?
I guess the only follow-up, Madam Chair, would be who determines what union is relevant.
Ms. Schneider?
Madam Chair and Representative Juergens, I would argue that unions that are working in the school building would be relevant, but ultimately this would be determined by the grantee.
Okay, thank you.
Follow-up? Okay. Representative Sandell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question relating to Article 4, Section 2, the Safe Schools Revenue. I think I remember from yesterday's discussion in the Ed Policy Committee, conversation about the governor's or the department's competitive grant program for safe schools. Am I mistaken about that, or is that program still in place? It's not mentioned here.
Mr. Melcher?
Madam Chair and Representative, the governor's recommendation here is to increase the safe schools revenue, which is an ongoing formula program, and not provide additional funding in this bill for the grant program that we had for hardening school sites. We did have a lot of interest in that. As you recall, we had many more school districts apply than we could fund. But in reviewing the priorities for safe schools with the governor's office, it was determined that safe schools revenue was the preferred approach, because this is funding that goes to every school district in the state rather than the lucky winners in a lottery, and that it provides the most flexible funding for school districts so that they can choose, do we want to do more on staffing to help make schools safer, or do we want to do more with the facility? So it puts the control in the local community, and it gives them the greatest amount of flexibility, and so that's where they put the dollars.
Great. Madam Chair, thank you. I think it's a good idea.
I think Mr. Strom is going to weigh in on this one, too.
Madam Chair, Representative Sandell, that was a governor's recommendation out of the capital budget, out of the bonding budget. So the $25 million there is a governor's recommendation, but out of the capital investment budget, not out of the K-12 budget. Madam Chair, I'm confused about my years. Please excuse everything I just said. That was a separate bill. I'm so sorry about that.
And we'll just pretend that wasn't spoken. That's okay. All right. Members, just a reminder, we are getting kind of close to our timeline here. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Snyder, on page 28, under the teacher mentoring programs. So this new language that's being proposed, will that conflict with mentoring for Tier 1 teachers?
Ms. Snyder.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, I'm not quite sure I'm following. How would it conflict with mentoring for Tier 1 teachers?
Well, this is saying that teacher mentoring programs have to be included or aligned with district teacher evaluation and peer review processes. And in Tier 1, we have that mentoring component. So,
Ms. Schneider?
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, thank you. This is intended to be language that relates to the mentoring grants versus a requirement on all teachers across the state. So that could definitely be clarified, and I appreciate you pointing that out.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So on line 4, the other funding source, because it states here that staff development dollars can be used, or another funding source to pay the stipend to the mentor, what might be another funding source?
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, other funding sources could include general funds, it could include the mentoring grants, it could include alternative compensation if they're in that program.
And one last question, Madam Chair, thank you. On line 10, what are affinity groups?
Ms. Schneider.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, that is a good question. I'm not sure. Some of these recommendations were adopted from the Coalition to Increase Teachers of Color and American Indian Teachers. to meet the goal of the governor and lieutenant governor to increase our teacher candidates of color, and this was adopted from their recommendation.
Ms. Schneider, if there's a definition, is that something you can find and get back to us on? Thank you. Any other questions, members? Okay, at this time, before we take public input, just a couple of things for members to look at in your folder. We do have a letter from Superintendent Wilding regarding the state academies, and there's also the A-19 amendment, which was referenced earlier. We're not going to take action on that. It did not meet deadline. We won't take action on that today, but we will be, just for context, that's in your folders, and it will be addressed at another committee meeting or another time. Right now, this is a public hearing. Any input from the public? Okay. Seeing none, with that, the chair renews Representative Dabney's motion to lay House File 2207 over for possible inclusion in a future division report. And with that, we are adjourned.